right party people. Woo!
May 6th. Right.
Are you ready to learn about some law? All right. Let's go.
That was way more exciting than I expected.
It's way more exciting than I had.
All right. I guess I'll start since I'm on the end. My name's Blake Sorensen. I am a patent attorney here in Atlanta. I'm also a sometime game developer, which is why I have a little bit of a unique perspective to bring on this. I think all of us were on this panel last year when this case was pending, and we all had our own predictions about how it was going to come down. Some of us were closer than others. I do a lot of IP-related work, a lot of licensing, not necessarily this sort of civil litigation, but like I say, I've done enough game development that I've looked into the issues pretty closely. That said, I'm a lawyer, so everything I say comes with a disclaimer. I am not your lawyer. Nothing I say constitutes legal advice, and nothing we do here creates any kind of attorney-client relationship. If you have any questions about things you might have done, please remember that attorney-client privilege does not apply. Thank you.
And make more violent video games for him to play.
Absolutely.
So my name is Brian Green, often known by the pseudonym Psychochild. I'm a game developer. I've worked professionally in the industry since 1998. Worked on a game called Rooney 59 that most of you probably haven't heard of. I also happen to be a resident of California, so I was kind of saw this up close and personal. I also helped write a book on business and legal issues in the game industry. So that's kind of how my soul's tainted enough to be up on this panel. Blake said, we kind of were talking about this last year, it was just pending, so now we're, I guess this is the reunion tour. Now we're talking about
it.
Exactly. About what the results are.
Excellent. My name is Andrew Greenberg. Like Brian, I'm a game developer, been doing that for far too many years, was the original developer of a little game called Vampire the Masquerade. I've gone on to do a lot of computer and video games over the year. I'm the director of a conference here in Atlanta called the Southern Interactive Entertainment and Game Expo. It's a professional game development conference. If you're interested in making games, come to this one and do a lot more of that than playing them. My other name is www.hauntedhousetycoon.com. That's my next title that should be shipping later this year. I kind of bring a unique perspective to this form as well. While I am not a lawyer and don't try to represent anybody, I have written about law for American Lawyer Media. I've specifically written about the laws over games for an organization called LexisNexis, which has a lot of publications for the legal trade. I have had my games accused of causing deaths and murders and wonderful things like that. And I have children, but only for dinner.
And following that, my name is TJ Myhill. I'm the other attorney, and I don't do any game developing, but I do represent a lot of game developers, and I do civil litigation, so that's what I bring to the panel. I'm the one who, haven't gotten to the Supreme Court yet, lost a whole lot of money, but would be the one to take these cases to court if they come up. So
I'll get you there someday. So
that's the perspective I bring. I do work with Andrew on Siege. I do work with the GGDA quite a bit, the Georgia Game Developers Association, and video game developers at all levels here in Georgia and throughout the Southeast. But much like Blake, I'm just what he said. No legal representation, no attorney-client privilege. We're in a big room, and this is being recorded. So,
you starting off, or am I starting off?
Why don't we start off with a quick, I don't know, a lot of people have kind of a general idea of what it means to go to the Supreme Court, but the quick 60-second version is the Supreme Court hears appellate cases. That means they don't have a jury. They don't see these cases up front. They see the results of cases that have been argued at lower levels, at the state level, and basically decide whether these cases were decided properly. So they don't really get to bring in new information. They only get to decide on what was brought in at the lower level, which they pretty much ignored in this case. Of the nine justices, four of them wrote opinions in this case. and two of them did extensive outside research to justify the... Well, actually, three of them did extensive research.
And they
if you count,
all their clerks played a lot of games.
Yeah, if you count Justice Thomas's historical... You know, descent into puritanical educational values. It's a very interesting historical treatise. What it has to do with the case, no one's really sure. So the case was decided by the Ninth Circuit originally, striking down the California law. It goes back, it goes up to the Supreme Court for them to decide if the Ninth Circuit was correct. Which usually Supreme Court doesn't like the Ninth Circuit, so the answer is usually no. But in this case, I think we all were pretty much on board with the idea that the Supreme Court was going to strike down this law banning the sale of violent video games to minors. We just weren't sure why. There are all sorts of reasons they could have chosen.
Let's get a quick sense of what you guys are interested in this particular case. I find it fascinating, but I'm a weird legal wonk on that matter. How many of you, I don't know, let's take a stretch, play violent video games? One. Oh, a couple. All right. Are you interested, who's interested primarily as a consumer? Because you buy and you play them. Interested because you have an interest in making them at some point? Nice. Because you're a weird legal wonk like those of us. Oh, yeah.
Yay.
Yay, legal wonk. Any other reasons that we're missing?
Wait, how many of you are under 18 and can't buy these things in California?
No, they all can now.
Everybody can.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, excellent.
Of any interest in California and how they have an unusual set on the rest of the country?
Yes, we do.
Supreme Court hates the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah.
We had another reason over here, I think.
First Amendment law.
Ah, okay. Well, this is a great case for it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of why we thought there would be, or why I thought there were going to be a lot of opinions, because it's a chance for the Supreme Court justices to rattle on and on about the First Amendment, which they all like to talk about.
Well, someone want to talk about the unique facts of this case? Because there were some unique issues being raised all the way around. I will if nobody
else. Are you asking us or them?
Okay, I'll sit here and listen.
Yeah. Where's the audience? Here the panel go.
Right.
What was the question, Matt?
What you were just asking.
Mike,
I was just interested because I'm writing my senior research thesis on sex and violence in media following Generation Y. So I'm more interested in the aspects of recent video game development and what the legal actions that parental right groups are taking, and how recent is that? Because the television part that I've wrote so far for my senior thesis, we start to see a huge shift in the late 90s where parental groups are starting to make, you know, you have to show whether it's rated for children 5 and under, or if it's rated for children 13 and older on television. So when do you start seeing that in the video game world? When does the pressure really start with parents on video games?
I can agree with the historical version. You want to take it, Brian?
Sure. I mean, basically, I've written quite a bit about this. It's kind of a concept I like to call legitimacy. You know, nobody talks about, paintings hanging in a museum about how this could be harmful to children. Why? Because we've kind of accepted that paintings are a legitimate means of art form. You kind of gotten a little bit of that with theater. We've started to see that with movies and television. You know, television's still kind of on that wild hairy edge. You know, video games are kind of the new scary medium for a lot of and throughout history we've always seen, you know, people, a new medium come along, whether it be novels or comic books or whatever, people rail about, oh, how this is corrupting our children, doing horrible things to us. And you've kind of seen, you know, I've done a little bit of research, you know, especially the two things I've looked at kind of being very similar is tabletop gaming like Dungeons and Dragons. Mike Stackpole, who's also a frequent speaker here at Dragon Con, you know, for several years gave a very wonderful discussion about, you know, that was called MAD, Mothers Against Dungeons and Dragons. And so it was very interesting to kind of see a lot of that parallel, and then also with comic books, with the internal censorship, the Comics Code Authority. But you know, eventually we kind of get to the point where we start to accept, you know, medium as being a lot more legitimate, and, you know, and when does that take place? I think the I think the benefit is that, you know, video gamers, especially video game designers, are very aware. You know, we like to analyze things, you know, to a large degree. So, like I said, we've kind of seen parallels between, you know, you talk about, like, the, you know, the ratings for television. You know, we have the ESRB, the Entertainment Software
Rating Board.
Rating Board, yeah, thank you. But basically, if you look on the front, it says, you know, whether it's, you know, T for teen or whatever. So I think we've started going down a lot of those paths so that, you know, make sure that we kind of try to avoid as much ire as possible from parents. But, you know, I think that the good thing about this ruling, from my point of view, is that basically the justices said unequivocally, video games are protected speech.
Yeah.
Period. End of line. No more discussion about that. So, you know, when the highest court in the land says, you know, you're, you know, to develop, you know, for developers, your the medium you're working in is protected speech, that takes a large load off. Then, you know, but then again, there's still a lot of ways that, you know, we have to kind of, you know, like, you know, even though theoretically movies and television are protected speech too, there's still a lot of pressures that groups can exert, you know, with, you know, sponsors pulling sponsorships and whatnot.
Let me add on to that real quick. Historically, there are rumblings of concerns for this going into, I remember back to the early 80s and certainly through the PMRC days, there's a little bit, but hip-hop's a far greater danger at that point in time. The real birth of legislation on the topic comes up with Columbine. Which I got caught a little bit of blowback on that one, but not nearly as much as Good Time Entertainment, id Software, and so forth. And that's when we really see the rash of it's all the video games' fault. Let's get them start coming up. And the interesting aspect of this is a lot of these laws came out. Georgia's actually, to my knowledge, and this was definitely true a few years ago, I think it's still true, is the only state that has a law regarding video games on the books that has not been challenged by the Electronic Software Association. That's because it was written by Thurman Baker in conjunction with the ESA and basically says, hey, we'll follow the ratings. So there's not much to it, but it's the only one that has not been challenged. And the ESA has succeeded in every single challenge against the violent video games law in the United States. Of course, overseas, a whole different question. Now, the interesting aspect of this is that the ESA rocks out like crazy. The ESA has really been pushing everybody, the retailers and the major publishers, to follow the ESRB ratings, your E for Everyone, like your mom up ratings that they put on stuff. But that's only really officially in retail. And now we're seeing digital distribution and online grow. That's a whole new can of worms. And one of the areas that this law has been very good is it makes developers of online media feel a lot safer in putting titles up and not have to worry about some wacko blaming them for the next Columbine or whatever else. So is that enough of a digression on your topic?
Why it has been exposed to an ever-growing, you know, presence of sex and violence. It's not until the 90s that parents, especially older parents, were in their 30s and 40s, are going, what are my children watching? But in fact, they've been watching it since 1983. And Generation Y is now at the tip where they're having children.
And that's an interesting aspect of this case because the justices, well, not the justices, Lee and the folks who bring the law are emphasizing that the parents don't have the sophistication of their children, which I find mind-boggling for a law where you're trying to limit what the kids can do when you're saying they're more sophisticated than the parents who are supposed to limit them.
Right.
But the people who create this law actually say that. So it makes for an interesting paradox.
It was kind of interesting, too, that Scalia, in the majority opinion, you know, recognized that there had been studies of how we were controlling access to various content for kids and said, you know, the video game industry outpaces the movie and music industries in restricting targeted marketing of mature related products to children, clearly and prominently disclosing ratings information, and restricting children's access to mature related or mature rated products at retail. So of the industries that we're worried about, video games are doing the best.
Another question?
I have sort of a Am I coming through? There. Two-pronged question. Throughout much of the latter half of the 20th century, going all the way back to the, I forget what the actual case is called, but the Born Innocent case, the media industries have dodged regulation by self-regulating, the RIA, the MPAA, and my first question is, what has the video game industry done wrong that the law is not willing to accept self-regulation on their part the way they are for many other industries? And then my second question is, what is the litmus test for violence as far as the California law went? Because our culture is very ambivalent about what kids should and shouldn't see. And we get a wild hair up our ass about nipple, but not about blood.
The answer to the first question, what did they do wrong? They didn't do anything wrong. Movies went through this. Yep. Music's gone through this. It's kind of a rite of passage for a new medium.
And in fact, video games have probably gone through it faster and less painfully. I mean, it really impacted what Hollywood's shown. The difference between the early teens and 20s stuff and what you saw through the 30s and 40s, dramatic. And games have gotten stronger and stronger along the way.
I mean, that's really the legitimacy question from before. The older something is, the more okay it is. The more established it gets, the more we're willing to accept that what it's showing has some worthwhile precedent. More importantly, all the 30 and 40-year-old parents probably go to movies and are okay with that. May not play video games. Certainly aren't playing necessarily the same games their kids are playing. They don't understand it. It's the scary new boogeyman in the closet, and therefore I'm more anxious about the violence in video games than I am in the movies. I'm more anxious about the violence in movies than I am in radio serials. More anxious about radio serials than I am in literature. Literature than painting. But every one of these had problems at the time. We just don't think of radio serials as the cutting edge of violence and gore anymore.
Oh,
at some point, though,
the hidden danger.
That's right. But that's exactly the progression, and it's not always a linear thing. It's not always it's brand new, and therefore, it's the scary medium. That's true, but there are a lot of ups and downs. Comic books were fine up until somebody really started taking a look at some of the really violent stuff that was coming out in the 50s and 60s. That's how we got the Comics Code. Movies were okay once we got into the 30s and 40s and 50s, as long as nobody tried to say damn. But
well, the Production Code of America, but again, that was not the Production Code of America,
and all the work of the Legion of Decency in the 30s was not backed by the force of law.
Right. Well, I mean, neither is the ESRB, neither is the PMRC, neither for the most part is the MPAA. The MPAA is just a voluntary ratings board. Just if you want to actually show your movie anywhere, you're going to get it rated, and you're going to follow the ratings. That's the power of that board. But it's a voluntary process. You don't have to have an MPAA rating to release your film, as long as it's going straight to video. But the reality is that all of that was fine, but think about the 80s. The 80s had the slasher films, the ability to make the effects look a little more realistic and be a lot more graphic created a whole new panic. And suddenly Freddy and Jason were the, you know, bane of our existence and were causing kids to kill each other. Now they're old news and we're dealing with the new issue. It's no different. It's just new.
And to make a quick note about the ESRB, the only issue with the ESRB, if you don't submit your games to the ESRB, certain retailers won't carry it. I mean, there's no other, you can still sell online, whatever. That's the only punishment to not submitting the ESRB. You had a second, didn't you?
Yeah, the second prong was how is the violence defined.
Oh, yeah, that's a great part. Oh, I love
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so of the four opinions, two of them are dealing with the definition of what is a violent video game. Basically, a quick summary of the four opinions. The majority opinion, which was written by Justice Scalia, said we don't restrict violent materials, period, end of story. It's protected by the First Amendment. We have no historical tradition of restricting that to anyone. You're done. It doesn't matter how you define violent. It's not a category we recognize as an exemption to free speech. The concurring opinion, which was Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts, said that the definition of what is a violent video game was impermissibly vague. Retailers would have no way of judging whether a game fell within the scope of the law. And basically the definition within the law was a game is violent if the range of options available to a player includes killing, maiming, dismembering, or sexually assaulting an image of a human being. And he basically said that, you know, even if we take that as being coherent enough to provide a non-vague definition, our society has long regarded that as perfectly suitable features of entertainment.
Entertainment.
The other problem with that definition, though, which what created the ambiguity in the definition, wasn't that it was just that aspect, which I think we could say, did you punch somebody in the face? Maybe that's violent. Is it too violent? That's a different question. But the ambiguity in the case comes in where they're trying to comply with some of the obscenity language in the hopes to get past these First Amendment restrictions. And they add in things that say, but it's perfectly okay to kill, maim, torture, or sexually assault if it's done for a legitimate artistic or
historical or educational.
Forget all the words. Yes, yeah. All the.
So my favorite is.
Go ahead.
My favorite distinction that they made when the discussion was, but can you do all these horrible things to a Vulcan? And the answer is yes. Supreme Court argument. It was a great discussion on Vulcans before the Supreme Court.
Yep.
And the decision was yes, that you could do every horrible thing to Vulcans as long as they're not a human, which leaves the question of half-breed Spock kind of still up in the air.
But anyway, one of the dissents, Justice Breyer, also turned on the definitions of violence and whether it was vague, and he said no, it's not vague, and basically went back to the old cliche: we know it when we see it. We know that this is a violent video game.
The guys who crafted this law really followed what the Miller test is the name of it, right?
For obscenity. Yeah,
really followed the Miller test for what is obscenity. This comes out of the 70s when the justices are saying, I can't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it. And then they have to define it.
No.
So Leland Yee was the main person behind this. He's a California assemblyman. Very dedicated to what he's doing, though I don't agree with him on a lot of his stuff. I think he's running for mayor now. He really emphasized, and he was trying to make this as close to the obscenity law as he possibly could to get it past the Supreme Court. So this also starts to throw some questions in front of obscenity laws as well, but they haven't been brought up to the court yet.
There we go.
Okay, great. Good. The big difference between all the previous forms of media and video games as a new media is that, in my opinion, like previously you're looking at a painting on a wall, you're looking at a picture on a wall, you're hearing things on the radio. In the video games, you are the person performing this action. And that suddenly comes into play of, is it acceptable for children and whatnot to be performing violent actions? And generally, most parents that I've come across are like, oh, no, I wouldn't want my children to beat up, another child. But then it comes into the question of, like, school bullies and things of that nature. Is the interactive portion what is really at the crux of the issue? Or is it more like, just that's moot in regards to this particular?
Absolutely moot, because in 1976 they wrote the first Choose Your Own Adventure book. So the Supreme Court has said that's interactive entertainment.
Yeah,
that was part of the majority opinion. So the interactive aspect was completely ignored, basically, by the majority opinion. They contended that all art, all literature is interactive to some extent because it ought to work you into the medium. As a practical matter, is that part of the process? Yeah. As a practical matter, that's something that bothers people more. But no one has been able to show that little Johnny pushing the button that punches the hooker in the face is any more problematic than little Johnny just watching the hooker get punched in the face. So until someone's able to make that distinction, and frankly, I don't think they ever will, but unless someone's able to make that distinction, then we're again just dealing with the nuances of the medium rather than the First Amendment provisions themselves. And the First Amendment says that speech is protected no matter how that speech is conveyed.
Now this is an interesting problem for developers like Brian and I. We have the conundrum of telling people, oh, games are better than other entertainment. You get to live the story. You get to be part of the role. Serious games will modify your behavior. You'll eat less. You'll have a better diet. You will learn important skills. But violent games won't teach you to kill anybody. Well, there's a couple of levels to this. One, we do anticipate a somewhat sophisticated audience. That doesn't mean pinky up audience. That means an understanding of the difference between reality and fantasy. That means an ability to accept what are positive and negative traits within their entertainment, and like, and to self-regulate what they allow as behavior modification and what they do not. Are we forcing some level of unconscious behavior modification on people? That's something for developers to continue looking at. Many of us who've played games, racing games, a great example, you then get in your car afterwards, and for a few seconds, it feels like you're still playing Gran Turismo or something along the lines, and things should be whipping by you much faster than they are, and what's wrong with your vehicle at this
point? Can you tell
point?
Me when you're driving home so I can...
It's Atlanta. Everyone just played Gran Turismo.
I have to agree with that. Yeah, I played Crazy Taxi, and as I was loading up music for our trip here, we drove from California. I went, oh, Offspring. Oh, no, no. So, I agree with Andrew completely. I think that... And as far as studies have gone, the studies about whether the interactive parts of games have an effect on behavior are inclusive. And I think that's one of the things they brought up, is that, you know, the state of California tried to draw a direct parallel between violent video games and harm to minors. But there really have, you know, there's been some studies that have, you know, maybe shown it, but then the results have not been duplicated in other studies. So, you know, basically if you want to be kind of inclusive, to my mind, you know, not being a professional, you know, academic or researcher or whatnot, I think it's pretty obvious. If you can't find an answer, it might not exist out there. So I obviously, the people that, you know, when you have somebody who has an obvious agenda, they're going to interpret the data in different ways. But the fact that you can, we've had so many different studies, and, you know, this has been a hot topic for years now, and we haven't had a single authoritative study, you know, kind of shows that there's probably not a definitive answer out there.
Or a single legitimate case of someone engaging in some illegal act because of they've just played the game and now they have to go do it. We have had people say that they've killed people because they didn't let them play games, but I don't think there's a... But certainly no courts have ever upheld the video game defense, as they like to talk about it. So I think that we can pretty thoroughly say now, after, 75, and after 35-some years of games out there, that so far we seem to have that sophisticated audience we believe exists.
Well, two things. I think with the adventure novels, you're using your imagination and not using something as realistic as video games are becoming. Secondly,
my brother wrote some of those books. They're real.
Right. But what I'm saying is video games are getting more and more like walking through the real world.
Yeah.
And you're assuming that your audience is being taught the difference between right and wrong. Yeah. Like, I love video games just as much as the other person. But if, as parents, they're not teaching their kids, hey, you shouldn't go out and shoot that old lady in the face and take her car, then that's where the issue comes in.
Well, and Alito's concurrence actually gets into that. He talks about the advancing technology, the advancing graphics, controllers that are more immersive, the Mech Warrior pod machines where you're completely immersed in the environment.
Those are really cool.
He accepts the IGDA's, the International Game Developer Association's amicus brief in this case, that said, you know, games are far more concretely interactive than other forms of entertainment. It says, now, he still supported striking down the law, but his concern was that the majority opinion, Scalia's opinion, was premature in dismissing the concerns by saying that all entertainment is interactive.
And that, I think, brings up a very interesting fact about this case. This case says that violent video games are okay. You can make them, you can sell them. You can sell them to kids. But it leaves open the door for 5-10 years from now, another case on this exact same issue, just because we've got something a little bit more high tech and a little bit more interactive and a little bit more scary to the general public. The other thing is to address your parent, your parental concerns. Absolutely, the idea of this law is whether the government is going to be your parent, and the Supreme Court has said no. The government will not take the place of your parents. Now, if parents aren't doing their jobs and nobody teaches little Johnny not to go beat up old ladies and steal their cars, well, then the government will take care of him in the prison system, I guess. But that's still the parent's job. And all this case says is if your kid comes home with a violent video game and you don't want him playing it, then you're the parent. Take it away. Or sit down and talk to him about it. Or whatever your role as parent is going to be. But it allows for the sale. It doesn't punish a retailer for the parents not doing their job, which is otherwise what would result. So nothing in this law suggests whether violent video games are good or bad. I think if you probably asked Scalia if he wanted to play Grand Theft Auto, I'm guessing no. But
he wants to play Hawk.
but that doesn't mean that they're illegal. This is simply a First Amendment case dealing with the government's ability to mandate speech.
But this does bring up my rant, which is that the focus on violent video games is the cause of these horrors and troubles and role-playing games and jazz music and poets, if you go back to Plato, is actually a really horrible distraction. It really ignores these root causes. We have spelled out at this point similarities between people who engage in psychotic acts. We know similarities within their background, like, that get washed over when the parent's going to start saying it's because their kid was playing video games. We're not going to look at the other horrible issues in Columbine or wherever else. Just completely whitewashes serious issues that need to be addressed, and millions of dollars go into exactly the wrong areas when we have real needs that they can be addressing. Rant off.
Thank you for that definition of government in its entirety.
Now, I think this is a good point, though, to bring up the dissent about parental responsibility, which was Justice Thomas. And this was a great, this was a wonderful opinion all about
his. He brought a Coke can on purpose. Just
he goes on and on. Okay, Justice Thomas is an originalist, which means he interprets the Constitution as everything in it was defined by the Founding Fathers.
No, we say he does it in original ways.
Well, this is the theory of his philosophy. And so he goes back and he's reading the Puritans' educational manuals for how children were supposed to be educated, the responsibilities of a parent in 1790, what have you. And he says that this law is fine because a child should be given nothing unless the parent explicitly approves it. It is the parent's responsibility to give them everything, and we have no problem restricting anything from a minor. A minor has absolutely no First Amendment right to access anything without the parent's explicit approval.
Children are property.
Children are property, essentially.
And Brent Franklin, who ran away as a child and started doing his own printing at that point just so he could express himself, should have been locked up.
Yeah.
Would have solved this whole revolution garbage.
Yeah, but if you ever want to read a diatribe on, you know, how miserable children were around that time.
I think we had.
Yeah, if I understood you correctly, you were suggesting, I thought that all we need is a study that links all of this, and it would be okay to curtail the First Amendment rights. Did I miss?
No, I don't want to give that impression. I think that if we had a study that links all this, we'd have a lot different discussion in the courts. But right now, one of the things the courts are saying is that while you make an argument that this interactivity creates a whole new problem not addressed by our previous look at TV or movies or radio or paintings or art or poetry, the interactivity does not change the First Amendment because you can't show that there's some change to the medium. It doesn't. It's just a new way of conveying the speech. The speech itself is still 100% protected. Now, if we were to be able to show that this does somehow alter the speech, then I think that the court would have to look at whether that is speech that is still permissible, which is a very, very, very broad range of speech, or if it's speech that that is possible to be curtailed, like the fighting words or the incitement. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. You can't show obscenity. But I still don't believe that it would fail the test. I think the court would still find that the speech is protected speech under the First Amendment. That's just how they got around the interactivity issue at this point?
Yeah, at this point, there are studies out there that link this, and they've basically been rejected as bad science in a lot of cases, and even where the studies are recognized as valid, they don't show any more effect on a child's development than watching a movie. So to really make another go at this, I think you'd have to have a study that showed there was a significantly higher detrimental effect than any other sort of art form.
I got a question over here.
We have a couple up here.
We got lots of questions.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask some before and after style questions. So what prompted Leland Yee's sort of crusade, just to get some context on that? And you mentioned something about this might have effects on the obscenity law because it was referring so strongly to it. So what are going to be some of the after effects of this ruling, if any?
So the cause of this is pretty obvious. He wanted to get votes. And you know, if you go out there and, you know, politicians get votes by showing that they're doing something. And if you can demonstrate a crisis, whether it's accurate or not, and say, look, I'm doing something for it. I mean, and he's still making political hay about this. Like Andrew said, he still went around the talk show circuit and said, oh, you know, isn't it terrible that the government's not going to protect your children from these horrible games? You know, and he's still out there. I mean, even though he got the ultimate smackdown that a politician can get in the U.S. you know, judiciary, he's still going out and trying to make political hay from this. So, I mean, ultimately, I mean, you know, Leland Yee, I don't live in his district, but you know, he has introduced a lot of other sensible, you know, litigation. So I have to believe he's not just a corrupt politician. Yeah, but obviously, you know, there is a bit of, you know, gaming, if I can use that word, I guess, appropriately, of trying to get votes. So, he at some level, he may believe he's doing this, you know, to save the children, to protect people. But, you know, it's pretty obvious that, you know, if you can zero in on a hot button issue and press it and say, look, I'm trying to protect your children, and everybody else is not, then you're going to get more sympathy.
Now, just a little bit on the flip side, I pretty fully agree with that, but on the flip side, he does style himself as a child psychologist. He does claim this comes out of his own work with children, and he has cost himself a bit. He's in San Francisco, which is the center of game development. He's cost himself a lot of money in donations, and he's definitely cost himself support within his own community. So he's making hay out of it and pushing that as far as he can to get bigger recognition, but at the same token, he understands there are risks to what he's doing, to his game.
Yeah, to the second prong, what changes are these rulings going to have? Not a lot. It's really been an endorsement of what's come before, that violence is not obscene. The obscenity tests simply don't apply to rating violence because it is not something we've historically treated as obscene material. So the test for obscenity remains the same, and violence remains protected First Amendment speech.
Right. I think the real issue of the impact on the obscenity test is that the obscenity test won't work backwards, won't work on other things. I don't think that there's going to be any change in how we regulate obscenity as a result of this ruling, because the Miller test is pretty well established. Obscenity prohibition is very well established in the judicial records. And frankly, that's what made a big issue here, is that obscenity is regulated for everyone. And they were trying to simply regulate violence for children. So obscenity, the reason we can regulate obscenity and the reason this test works, according to the opinion, is that we're doing it across the board. Obscene is obscene is obscene. Whereas violence seems to only be a problem if it's being viewed by a minor. And that's where the court took exception to being able to curtail that legal speech. The other aspect of this is just really America's history. I mean, he brought it out earlier. You can behead 75 people in a row, but God help you if you're a topless woman doing it.
Right.
and we just don't like nudity here in America, but we're more than okay with violence.
No. Our politicians don't like nudity. I'm a big fan of them.
But only if they're in the airport bathroom. So the area where I think this does, where I do think this affects obscenity laws, is I don't think that anyone is going to seriously try and push more obscenity legislation or expand it in any way. I think this is pretty definitive. Don't go beyond what's already out there. And, you know, the folks, the people creating entertainment can start nibbling away at those edges more and see where we can end up. The law is pretty set now not to go beyond.
All right. You mentioned recently with parents not necessarily knowing what their children are doing because of the sophistication, but over the past few decades, the gamer age has rapidly increased, and it's currently 37 ages old. So how does that, do you think that affected their opinion at all?
It didn't really come out. They didn't mention that, apart from saying that parents are, in the majority opinion, saying that parents are competent enough to understand the ESRB system.
Zynga likes to say that the new hardcore gamer is a 42-year-old woman, and they're pretty much right by the definition of how much time they spend playing games. That is the new hardcore gamer. But the law was about children, so none of that really played much role into the fact that we do have a mature gaming base.
I think it is related in that there's a great book by Scott McCloud, Understanding Comics. It's about comics, but if you could get a PDF of it and substitute comics for video games, like 90% of it would apply. But one of the things he talks about, specifically about obscenity, is that, you know, he says for comic books, as long as they're seen as for children, then any charges of obscenity are going to stick. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very similar thing for video games. I think the fact that the demographic is being older, is, you know, some of us are getting a little older playing games all our life. We are able to say, look, these are not, you know, video games are not intended solely for children. You know, we are able to get around some of that, and basically that is one of the critics. You know, like they said, you know, because they tried to apply this to children, you know, that was overly restrictive. The problem is if they didn't apply to children, then it would be a lot more obviously a First Amendment issue, because you have the chilling effect. You know, because if you start regulating and say, it's specifically for children. You know, if you can't sell a game for children, then what's going to happen? You know, a lot of the large retail stores are like, well, it's too much trouble to make sure children don't buy it. We don't want to, you know, do a fine, so we're just not going to sell any games whatsoever. And so that's the problem you get into. I mean, you know, a lot of the, like Walmart specifically, one of the biggest retailers for video games, won't carry the top rating, which is AO, adults only, which is essentially is the equivalent of the NC-17 rating. Where you can go buy an NC-17 movie, but you can't buy the equivalent game within a lot of retailers. So,
and the real issue, again, this is all wonderful discussion for the panel, and I want to encourage this discussion. But as far as the ruling, the ruling doesn't address what parents ought to be doing. Well, unless you're looking at Justice Thomas, the court isn't trying to say how parents should parent. The court isn't trying to say whether or not kids should play these games. The court is simply saying, can these games be sold? And is it a crime if a retailer sells it to a minor? Is this a free speech question? The issue with free speech is, can government control it? See, you've got to remember that the First Amendment says government can't stop you from speaking. It doesn't say I can't stop you from speaking. It doesn't say I can't kick you out of my store if you say something I don't like. It certainly doesn't say I can't kick your ass if you say something that pisses me off. So those are the kinds of things that aren't regulated, and they're not addressed by this opinion any more than they are in any other medium. So how parents will be addressing the game and what we should do as parents and how we as gamer parents should watch our children, those are fantastic issues that we ought to be discussing. But like Andrew said, the problem is the government wants to step in and curtail that discussion, and instead of addressing the real issue and having us try to figure out how to be good parents, the laws that are being presented and struck down by the Supreme Court are to avoid that issue and to avoid me having to decide whether my kid should play this game, because we just won't sell it to him.
I'm wondering, why do you think video games are taking such a beating in the sense of the media and with legislation? When I grew up, I grew up watching Tom and Jerry and Foghorn Leghorn. I didn't go beat my dog with a plane. I mean, why are video games all of a sudden a bad thing, but violent cartoons when I was a child weren't?
Really? Because I was looking for that Acme catalog.
Dynamite, you can get my mail order. That'd be awesome.
Well, look who's doing the complaining. The media, who feels that their market's being taken away from them. That's one of my first things I go to. The people who are complaining are the ones who are losing market share to games.
And the politicians who want votes.
And politicians who want votes. And I mean, it goes, like everyone else was saying, what Thomas was saying, it goes back to jazz being blamed, it goes back to heavy metal, and Ozzy Osbourne's obviously a danger to society. It goes back to
don't
hip-hop.
Do drug, kids.
Ozzy's a danger, but really only to Ozzy.
We're the flavor of the month, and it is competition. There's opportunity here to make money by complaining about something, and there's competition that you don't like.
You were talking earlier about parents like teaching their kids right and wrong and stuff, and I think I heard, because I didn't see like the actual transcripts or anything, I just read articles off of like G4 and other places, and one of the things I heard was what they wanted to do was get something like maybe a sticker that says violent or something to put on the games, that and plus what the ESRB does. And do you think part of that was maybe just maybe some parents are getting lazy or something? Like, because the front will say like teen, mature, whatever. But then if you turn it to the back, it'll say why it's rated that. And if you go on ESRB's website, they'll tell you detailed why it's rated that. So I mean, I didn't see any reason to like go to court about it because it seems pretty clear there.
Yeah, it wasn't really addressed at the Supreme Court level, but at the Ninth Circuit level, they talked about that. The law did require games that were deemed violent to carry a 3x3 sticker on the front of the game, which, I mean, if you've seen an Xbox or a PlayStation, that's like a third of the box.
Great ad.
Yeah, it's a great ad, and that was one of the things that I think the ESA brought up. But one reason that the Ninth Circuit said this is struck down, because the First Amendment, it's not only you can say what you want, it's also the government cannot tell you what to say, and having to put that sticker on the front of your box is government-sponsored speech.
In your personal, non-legally binding opinion, what do you think of the ESRB? Do you feel like it is a useful organization? Would you keep things the same if you could, or would you change them? Would you get rid of it altogether?
You want the punching gloves first?
So, I mean, I really haven't run into ESRB much personally. I worked for a couple of years for a large publisher. And they applied for all the ESRB ratings, and then I worked as a small developer, and I slowly threw online. From that perspective, I never applied for ESRB rating. From that perspective, I think that one of the big problems of the ESRB is it's basically kind of out of date. It's really intended for, we're going to put this into a retail channel or through limited channels. I mean, look at the same thing with the movies, where you have the ratings. Well, why do you have the ratings? Because they're shown at these large places. But you notice YouTube videos don't have, this YouTube video has been rated R. You kind of see that it's becoming a little obsolete, and as we're kind of becoming, as our media becomes a little smaller, distributed online and that type of thing. I think larger there are some issues, and I think this is kind of the same thing shared by like the MPAA that does the movie ratings and whatnot. It tends to, since it's kind of an internal thing, sometimes it's a little more interested in politics, kind of petty politics, than actually protecting people or doing its job. A great example, kind of pulling from the Comics Code Authority, that really kind of showed how the Comics Code went from being something we're going to protect children and get Congress off our back to being petty personal politics. There was this one really great story, science fiction story. I'll try to keep this short, but. The punchline basically this astronaut goes, these two robots, one's purple, one's orange, and the purples are in dominance, and they're subjugating the orange, and the guy's trying to say, you're just the same. But they wanted to apply to this Galactic Federation type thing. And at the end, he's like, the astronaut's like, I'm going to have to deny their application because obviously they don't believe in equality. He takes off his helmet, and he's a black astronaut. And the Comics Code Authority, the person that reviewed that, said, no, that astronaut cannot be black. No reason given, just he can't be black. And the author of the story is like, that's kind of the whole point of the of the story. And eventually the guy kind of, like the astronaut had beads of sweat. Okay, you have to take off the beads of sweat. But obviously there's nothing wrong. This guy wasn't involved in protecting children. He's just a racist bastard that didn't want, a black guy showing up in comics. And I'm not saying that the ESRB or the MPAA necessarily do that, but that's kind of one of the dangers that we can look at. If people get more interested in you know, the petty politics aspect of it, rather than actively giving information out, which it should be.
Let me give a quick history on the ESRB. When it came into existence, there are actually several competing ratings organizations, because this makes money. This is a the publishers pay a lot of money to get this stuff reviewed and put on shelves. And it doesn't provide much defense for the game makers. It provides defense for the retailers when mommy comes running in and says, you sold my child this horrible game. They can say, you knew it, or, well, they lied to us that this shouldn't be in there. And then you get the Grand Theft Hot Coffee issue, which will pop up and be made into far more than it was. But I've had to submit a number of my games to the ESRB, and early on it was a cluster. It was pretty ridiculous. My favorite story, and got a few of them, my favorite of my personal interactions with them, we submitted a game called Machiavelli the Prince to them, wonderful game of Renaissance-era politics and trading, wherein you could explore the world, you could spread the bubonic plague in order to drive up prices, you could buy yourself cardinals in the College of Cardinals in the Vatican, and then you could assassinate the Pope, have yourself elected Pope, wonderful things like that. None of that was an issue, of course. We also allowed you to slander the other players in the game, and we gave you some pre-made slanders. Most of them were Shakespearean. You have the French pox. You are a vile knave. You do not sleep with courtesans. Those sorts of insults and slanders. The one they complained about and held up our E rating over was, you are a pocket fisherman. That was what held it up. So, yeah, there were definite issues with the ESRB. That said, the ESRB has gotten more effective in dealing with designers and publishers. They didn't used to completely hide what their requirements were and how they made their judgments. Now that's a bit more open, and it's a lot better than the rating boards in other countries where they don't have the same constitutional protections. It is more effective as well. But like Brian said, it's really pretty outdated at this point. It serves its purpose of giving the retailers cover, and that's really about it.
From and just one quick thing about it, the NPA and the SRB. So everybody involved in rating the video games, basically it goes between a panel and then they decide whether or not, you know, what the accurate. Everybody on that panel has to work with kids in one form or another. So kind of going back to our previous discussion about, you know, the age of the average gamer, again, kind of showing how they're a little outdated, you know, so, you know, Grand Theft Auto goes in front of it, and, you know, the priest is shocked and dismayed. This, you know, the elementary school teacher is horrified, and the mother of six is, you know, thinks this, you know, she would never want her kids to see this. So, you know, you don't necessarily get a very accurate rating for what gamers, you know, are interested now.
That said, I want the same rating systems that books have.
From an end user perspective, I don't think there's really a problem with it. The issue I think that's going to be coming up more and more is that, you know, you take the movie ratings board, they get a panel, they sit down for 2 hours, they watch the movie. But the ESRB has got to go through the entire game.
Well, and we give them walkthroughs. Yeah, do the whole thing.
I mean, they don't have to play it, but they still got to go through the entire plot line, all the variant plot lines. And, I mean, games today are, what, 20, 30 hours of playtime? Some of them. And especially if you've got a game that's got multiple, you know, take any BioWare game, where you've got 17 different plot lines that you can follow. Yeah, it's a hugely intensive effort to go through all of that. And it's just going to be getting, you know, that's going to be getting more and more of a problem as these turn even more interactive. And it's going to be more time-consuming, which means more expensive, and it's going to be pushing up the prices of games.
Let me just jump in here as the only non-game developer on the panel. But see, I don't deal with the ESRB. Now, as an end user, I'm no bigger a fan of the ESRB than I was the MPAA in the 80s when they were taking all my slasher movies away. That being said, now as an attorney, when I'm trying to advise my clients, I'm a big fan. I don't have to deal with them, so I don't have to go through all the headache of dealing with the ESRB. But having that internal rating, having some self-regulating system, and as we move away from retail, you know, big box store sales and into downloading and into electronic delivery and into, you know, the iPhone and Android apps and everything else that's not rated, I would encourage the industry to find an internal regulation mechanism for those as well. Because if you have that type of internal regulation, the courts are going to look more kindly on your product. one of the big reasons I think that this is a case that we're discussing today, where the court found this is free speech and it's okay and we can do what we want and we can sell these games, is because there's something on it that says T or M or AO. If it didn't say that, would it still be free speech? Probably. But would there be some way to restrict sale? Would there be some way to restrict retailers and what they could do? I think the court would be more open to that idea because there wouldn't be an easy answer for the consumer. So that type of open ratings, as an attorney representing game designers, I'm a big fan of it. As a game designer, you guys have a whole different opinion.
Just don't let the rating systems be Apple.
Well, and jumping off of that real quick, there is one other issue with the system that they should probably be starting to address, and that's something that's on almost every game now. Online interactions are not rated by the ESRB.
Right.
And one of the things that, you know, boosted Scalia's ability to get a majority in this is that the ESRB is there and it gives parents a channel. If someone makes a strong case that the ESRB is failing because games are not validly rated, we open the door to another try at a law like this.
Just go ahead.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. As you mentioned earlier, things that were starting to lose business, starting to lose money, were complaining about the ones that were coming up behind them, like movies were complaining about video games. How long until the retailers start complaining about the downloadable content?
Already happened.
Yeah, 5 years ago?
Yeah, big time. It's an issue for Steam, it's an issue for Directed Drive, they're all having to... As soon as the Columbine incident involving them pops up, then it'll really start... Issue.
I think Microsoft is requiring ESRB ratings for XBLA games.
Xbox Live, yeah.
I can finally go? Okay.
Oh, we're done, sorry.
Yep. Time's up. Thank you.
What I've been thinking about through this whole panel is, despite this ruling in the favor of violent video games, has there been kind of almost a paranoia created within the game developer industry of... what are we going to do that's going to end up pushing the envelope and making something like this come up again?
There's more of a sense of relief right now. There was starting to be this, oh my God, what if fear before the Supreme Court ruled, especially since the ruling dragged out for a while. So I was at the GDC this year and everyone saw, oh yeah, we'll be fine, but what if we're not? Right now that concern isn't that big. Right now everyone's saying, okay, we're free, let's go ahead and make cool things, let's not be looking over our shoulder all the time, but they still have the ESRB over their shoulder for anything big. There's still, that's always been a greater concern than what California was going to do in courts. So right now that dread's not there. Wait for the next Columbine that's blamed on games.
And just in general, you know, game developers aren't terribly politically savvy, just to be, you know, not too frank about it. I mean, most developers are in the industry, they just want to make cool stuff, and if cool stuff is defined by decapitations, then they'll make that, you know. Game developers tend to kind of go in waves too, you know, and Grand Theft Auto is the big thing, and everybody else wanted to do some kind of crime-based thing, and I don't think it's because, you know, any specific developer said, yes, robbing, you know, beating up hookers and taking their money, or, you know, stealing cars is awesome. It's just, you know, the setting made for potentially interesting gameplay, and so people went with that. I think that, you know, in general, yeah, there's a little bit of that, like, okay, how could this impact my work? But I think in general, people are, you know, by and large, the industry is going to ignore it until there is a Columbine level crisis that comes along, and then there'll be a flurry of panic, and we'll see how things go.
And I'll go into my other rant right now, that as long as the game design industry looks like Blake, Brian, myself, and TJ, even though he's not a game designer, we're going to still have a kind of strong focus on ice.
This is just audio recording, not video recording.
That wasn't me, just for the audio.
Let the record show.
I was saying something, wasn't I?
Yeah,
it was unimportant.
It was a rant.
You were ranting about the as long as the game developers look.
Oh yeah, as long as it looks like this, we're going to have a pretty strong focus on certain types of games. And really, 90% of the game development audience, developers in the United States look like us. So as that broadens, we'll start seeing a greater distinction on types of games, and this will become less of a worry because you'll be seeing more more games that are distinctly different than the violent games, which are fixed in some people's head.
Well, and even though it's your rant, let me interject. I don't necessarily see that that's going to be a good thing. I think as we get more a wider variety of games, I think that might incite more panic in people where video games are already the new medium. rubbing your hands there. Video games are already the new medium to kind of make people uncomfortable. Now you have games that people parents already can't relate to games if they can kind of recognize the content. Now you get content they can't possibly relate to. I think that could be even more horrifying to some people.
Yeah.
No, as a game developer and a game player, I'm excited about that. I just worry about
weird is scary.
What the soccer mom, the middle-aged soccer mom in the heartland is gonna, how she's gonna react, and that's basically what drives a lot of the fear, is people like that.
Again, though, as an outsider perspective, I mean, obviously you guys are having to deal with this and dealing with how am I gonna make the most money and reach the widest audience, and I want everybody to play my game, and that's a good goal. You should be shooting for that. By the same token, let's say that this case had gone the other way. It's not protected speech. You can't sell these to minors. These are never going to be sold in a brick-and-mortar store. They shouldn't be, available for easy download. They should be treated exactly like obscenity. So all of this is going to be treated exactly like obscene material. Now, I don't want to shock anyone in here, but porn is available. I realize that may be again, it's going to impact the marketplace. It's going to impact the business model. And what you would see might be a lot more, Angry Birds rather than Grand Theft Auto. But I don't know, maybe Angry Birds is violent.
Grand Theft Birds, I'm looking for it.
Those pigs aren't going
to... I mean, but the thing is, again, looking at comics, what happened to comics? I mean, how many people here read superhero comics? Yeah. How many people read manga? Yeah, so, I mean, basically that's what happened with the U.S. industry, where, basically the U.S. comics industry got so hyper-focused on superhero comics that basically that's all they did. And then you look at manga, where you basically have wide variety of stories. And if the court case had gone the other way as a professional, I'd start learning even more languages. I already speak Spanish and a little bit of German, but, I'd probably be looking for, in 10 years, where's the video game equivalent manga is going to come from?
So interesting Germany side note. Doom just went on sale.
Yes. Because it's only of a historical interest and longer appealing to teenagers.
You'd mentioned that the ESRB does not regulate or rate online content, online interaction. Assuming that the focus eventually shifts there, does that put it on developers to somehow regulate interaction between players, or is it going to be a legal issue of... Essentially, the game doesn't matter because what we're talking about is an interaction between two people that, I mean, how could you possibly rate that?
I think the easiest solution there is just to make it more of a call out to parents. Because right now, what they see is, this is rated E for everyone, and not necessarily reading the fine print on the back where there's some stuff that's not rated. If they can keep it at least some sort of indication that there is content that might be not in line with this rating, or maybe they have a new rating system that says E for everyone /O online content that may involve something that the parents wouldn't want to see, in which case, maybe... ideally, where the government isn't the parent is keeping an eye on what the kids are saying. If the game developers can make a way that's easier for the parents to keep in touch with what the community is saying, great. Do parents watch everything on TV that their kids are going to see beforehand? Probably not. But, making the facility available, even if it's not used, would be an argument against needing legal regulation.
I think that basically I've been an MMO developer since I started working professionally in the industry. Basically, it comes down to exactly what you said: online interactions between two people. We can't possibly possibly regulate that. You know, if we create the content, obviously we can regulate that some
extent. You can, but it's Club Penguin.
Essentially, I mean, well, even then, this one guy I worked with tells a great story about how he consulted, and I think it was a Toontown, where basically originally you could only communicate with other people through drop-down menus. And so you had a list of approved words. And he said that, you know, basically he showed the futility of that when one person went to another person and said, I want to stick my long neck giraffe into your fluffy white bunny. And nobody here has, you know, everybody here knows exactly what that means. But, you know, and that's the approved word list. So, I mean, even if you restrict it down to the point of, you know, even in Club Penguin, you know, again, it's Disney, so everything's fine and happy and no bad things ever happen to anybody that enjoys the Disney product, of course. But I'm sure that, you know, you're going to have people that are going to be able to another thing they had was like friend codes, and so basically there was this whole rigmarole of I jump three times, okay, the first digit is three, I do some hand signal, okay, that means K, I do something else, you know, communicating through the game, you know, you can try to regulate the interaction, but you really can't. So I think that's what the ESRB, you know, online interactions, and we are not rated.
But one thing developers have to be careful about, and some folks watch it, some don't, is downloadable content for rated games. Because you're not going to go to the ESRB to rate all your patches.
Right.
So you do have to be very carefully self-monitoring that so there's not backlash from it. I mean, you don't do anything wrong by giving them something for free because they didn't buy it at the store, but how many parents can tell the difference at that point?
Right.
Any other
next?
Just waiting for me to talk some more.
Hello? Okay, this is just a mind question more than anything. For going back to non-online content, let's say 5 years from now, somebody like puts Cleverbot in their game, and so it's completely non-deterministic content being created. Could that ever get past the ESRB?
You have to be able to show the ESRB one way or another, video, walkthrough, something, the permutation of the game that could be a concern. And if you have something that could be a concern and you can't show it, you got to get rid of that.
Yeah.
So otherwise, you will have a hot coffee incident again.
Right. I mean, the other thing that's kind of been on my mind recently, my current project is called Storybricks. It allows people to tell stories within an online work. You know, so how do we deal with that? You know, if I give you, you know, essentially each brick is a story element. So you say the queen wants necklace. Let's say you write a very violent or sexually tinged story. You know, even that, if I didn't intend for it to be used that way, like I said, you know, people are very creative in how they use limited tool sets. So if I give you a story, you know, and you start creating sexual content or overtly violent content, you know, how does that impact me as a game developer when it's your content hosted through my service? That's a whole other level of headache.
In literature, historically, there have been several works that were big touchstones that made people go, this work is bad. This is why we need to examine this. I'm wondering, I'm not a big gamer, so y'all have to tell me, maybe Grand Theft Auto, maybe another, but has the touchstone game that's going to be the center of the conflagration, the Fanny Hill or the Catcher in the Rye of video games?
Postal 2.
I'd much rather hold up.
But that was the one that was shown in court. That was the one they all examined as being a perfect example of a violent video game that should be banned for the sale to children.
Yeah, and I had the same publisher as Lou for a while. He was doing Postal 1. We were doing our Nova Mata game with Panasonic Interactive Media. Great guy, but he knew fully what he was trying to create with that, something that would get as much reaction as possible. No. Thus, they got Gary Coleman in it. The other games that have been notable in this have been, as you know, the Grand Theft Auto, but also Doom has been a major touchstone in this area. And you see others sometimes brought up that nobody knows. Custer's Last Stand is a perfect example. Is that okay, so everyone here knows about that. Never mind.
Replay.
And
I only know about that through purely academic interest, mind you.
Yeah. Really, they should have been after banning E.T. A whole different game issue.
I don't know. What about Pac-Man? I mean, he had to kill all those guys. He's going to be ghosted.
The drug use, the techno music. That goes under the Rave Act. That's not under censorship. Should we go ahead and do some wrap-up comments on the...
I think we're at time.
Yeah. I got another panel to get to.
So, like I say, if you want to go and pull down the opinion, it's and if you have any interest in judicial philosophy at the Supreme Court level, it is a really great example of seeing the different shades, especially among the quote-unquote conservative justices, because you get Thomas, Alito, and Scalia all arguing different points. So from a judicial philosophy, it's a really interesting opinion.
Yeah, as a developer, I'm really happy, and as a citizen in California, I'm very happy with the way it went. It's, like I said, the whole legitimacy issue, it's very gratifying to say, yes, the thing you've been building a career on for the past decade and a half is actually something worthwhile. So it's always very nice.
Yeah, I'm sorry I can say that mine's worthwhile. I've done my best to battle that stigma left and right.
You are a legitimate part of
the
I'll go back to gratuity. But there is a sense of relief within the industry for a short bit, and it's already kind of being forgotten at this point. The ESRB is more the issue to be dealt with and how we're going to handle downloadable. So there will be more issues coming up in the not-too-distant future, just not tomorrow, thankfully.
But that'll give us something to talk about next year.
Right.
Yay! So fill out your ratings things, and we'll do it again when the next crazy thing happens.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming.
Thank you all very much.
And I promise I know more about law than water pitchers.
Realistic water physics?